Conference record has joined the conference.
Okay. All right, good afternoon, everybody. We're having a security problem out of power making. An unknown force out there is responsible. We have a limited amount of time and a lot to cover today. We can get it done. We have to stay a little bit late. We can do that. My name's Jim Introne. I'm co-chair of this group, and in my real life, I'm deputy secretary to the governor for healthcare. I don't have a name tag. Jason Alderson today. Thank you all for coming. I know you all have very significant obligations. Taking time away from your ongoing obligations is a lot to ask of you. I think this is important work. This is one of the 10 working groups of the Medicaid redesign team. Our goal is to develop recommendations for consideration by the full Medicaid redesign team in the area of affordable housing. That's what the title, Affordable Housing Work Group, but I think everybody understands that our concern is principally about the affordable housing, where services and housing come together for individuals with complex needs. So we have a limited amount of time to get our work done. There's not an expectation that we're going to solve all the problems world of supportive housing, but our hope is that we'll at least be able to get to the point where we can construct a pretty well-defined agenda that will be a basis for future work and some activities, some recommendations. Hopefully that can be part of next year's budget and program agenda. So our format today is going to be try and set a baseline of information. I think it'll be helpful when people are trying to address particular problems if they work off the common information base. I'm sure we'll get to a point where everybody knows as much as everybody else in this room. We all have areas of expertise, but at least we're going to try and familiarize everybody with the broad range of issues. Range of considerations that are relevant to this particular area. But before we get into the presentation that is scheduled for today, I think it would be useful to go around the room and let everybody introduce themselves and maybe 30 seconds, 20 seconds about your experience or who you're working with. I'm going to start with staff for the group. Mark Kissinger from the State Health Department and Andrew Cohen from New York City are intended to act as staff to our group and try and keep us on the straight rail path. So we'll start with Mark and Andrew.
Sure. As Jim said, my name is Mark Kissinger. Involved with long-term care for pretty much my whole career. Looking forward to staffing this group, and I'm just going to give a little bit of when people present, if they can come up to the chair by the computer, that'd be helpful, or if they want to do it from their seat, we'll do it from the computer that way, but kind of a little direction on mechanics there. But thanks for allowing me to do this job.
I'm Andy
Cox.
I work in the mayor's office in New York City. I work for Deputy Mayor London, the Deputy Mayor for Hope and Human Services, and I work mostly on health issues. I'm a little bit newer to the housing issues, but was very involved in the behavioral health subcommittee and worked on Medicaid most of my career. So
Tina Hernandez, President of Samaritan Village, large drug treatment agency,
also former chairman of the Housing Authority for Vancouver for 8 years. Charles King, president and CEO of Housing Works in New York City.
Jason Lipman, senior associate for policy and advocacy of the Coalition of Behavioral Health Agencies.
I am Luan Michelle. I am the director of the CSA, Corporation for the Housing New York Program.
Lisa Newcomb, Executive Director of the Empire State Association of Living, and we represent approximately 250 adult homes and rich housing programs, assisted living residences, and assisted living programs, which is our Medicaid program for assisted living.
Hi, Lindsay Miller from the New York Association on Independent Living. We're the Association for Independent Living Centers, which are community-based non-profit providers of services, support, and advocacy, run by people's facilities, for people's facilities. And among many of the services that are kind of provide housing, education, advocacy, and assistance for individuals that are looking for accessible, affordable, integrated housing.
Good afternoon. My name is Pete Bowles. I'm a senior vice president for Loretto, located in Syracuse, New York, and I lead the team there that drives on assisted living, supportive housing, and retirement housing, and healthcare facilities.
Good afternoon. I'm Deborah Dam O'Brien, and I'm the executive director of DePaul Housing Management and Catholic Charities Housing in the Roman Catholic Diocese of Albany. DePaul Housing Management operates the market rate and subsidized housing for seniors in the 14 counties of the Diocese of Albany, and the Catholic Charities Housing Office operates our supportive housing for people who have been homeless.
Tony Hannigan, I'm the CEO of the Center for Urban Community Services. We've been providing supportive housing since 1983 and currently provide services to about 2,000 units for housing to
Ted Howland, the Executive Director of the Supportive Housing Network of New York. We're a member association representing nonprofit developers and providers of supportive housing, about 200 of them across the state.
So, yeah, housing, we operate four services, approximately 1,000 beds in both home and assisted living program beds, but also a board member of NICO. And I have served on the work in 2003 on the adult home board.
So, I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Mental Hygiene at the University Health Department. The Health Department administers and oversees
contracts with the supportive housing providers for a variety of initiatives, the New York, New York initiative, and others, as well as HAWQA for HIV.
Good afternoon, Marjorie Hill, CEO, Gay Men's Health Crisis. We provide a full range of service, supported services for people living with HIV and prevention education services as well.
Good afternoon. I'm Lorraine Brown, Senior Vice President at the New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation. We serve 1.3 million low-income people every year, many of whom need supportive housing. Very specifically, we have more than 3,000 people in our skilled nursing facilities, and many of those individuals could benefit from home and community-based services. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Ginger Landy. I'm director of the New York chapter of the Assisted Living Federation of America, and the ALFA is the nation's largest provider association that represents professionally managed assisted living for seniors. And our members are very interested in a mixed income integrated assisted living program that's affordable.
Good afternoon. I'm Bobby Watts, Executive Director of Care for the Homeless. We provide primary care, mental health, and social services to homeless people, working with a number of shelters, safe havens, soup kitchens, and with street outreach programs.
Good afternoon. I'm Steve Presley, the CEO of Harlem United, and we provide housing, health care, and prevention services to the homeless with HIV or AIDS.
Our co-chair, Ed Matthews, who's executive director of New York City United Children's Policy, could not be here tonight. The association decided to have their annual conference. He's asking to extend his apologies. Thank you all again. It's certainly an impressive group. A great amount of knowledge is in this room, and we hope to be able to tap into that. Our mission. We're going to prepare a rather extensive slide package here that, again, is hopefully will help set our baseline of information. We're going to have presentations from several state agencies that have a significant role in housing. And most of them have introduced themselves here today. And I think Ted is going to present as well from the voluntary agency standpoint. And if we have time at the end of the meeting, we'll go around and ask for observations from the members of the work group. So let's start. I don't know who had it for the work. And General was just to say, coming to the association committee, let me just join us.
Thank you, Ted.
Sorry, my
train was very late.
Availability of necessary care and services. Supportive housing will be broadly defined as any combination of market rate or subsidized housing and services that will meet the needs of the target population. As we go through this, I think we hopefully will keep our discussion limited, but if anybody feels that they have a major issue to raise, point of contention, feel free to jump in, and we can discuss it. But without objection, we're going to take this as our general charge for the workroom. Okay, and then we can begin with, the presentation. Oh, my gosh, we're going on for everything. Identifying barriers to efficient use of available resources. I won't go through these in great detail. You have them in the package. You can see them.
identifying opportunities for the investment of additional resources that would result in savings to the Medicaid program and improvements in the quality of services to the targeted individuals. And making the recommendations, the work group should be mindful of the rights of individuals conferred upon them by the Olmstead decision and applicable federal and state law. Shall also be mindful of resource limitations that affect state and local decision making. The recommendations will create opportunities for stakeholders to contribute ideas and other information, and will consult with New York City and other local governments and authorities actively engaged in the provision of housing. This work group is related to the MRT recommendation 196. For those of you who are not familiar with it, the website, the Medicaid Redesign Team website, contains all of the information of the various things, the work of the various work groups, the meeting schedule, the meeting agenda, and the information presented at the work group meetings, including this work group, will be available on the MRT website. Okay, so with that, any questions, concerns, comments?
I just wanted to clarify when we say that we're deciding to support housing broadly, that we're not just looking at housing that has services attached or housing that's paid for by Medicaid. So we're looking at the broader affordable housing spectrum that includes, you know, housing that has, SME or families of that, which is people with disabilities. So
agreed, and I'm glad you raised that. We've had discussions about that after we put this charge together and got the oversight where we are intended to cover availability of accessible housing for new populations. And we'll make that change. Anybody else? Okay, I'm going to turn it over then to Mark.
Okay, in the interest of time, I'm just going to whip through the first slide to give you the Department of House impact or perspective on housing. And you're going to hear some themes that go through all the presentations and the projects will overlap. So the Department of Health is a huge department with a number of wide ranging responsibilities. One of them, and I'm going to do like three chunks. First one is on the Medicaid side. The second is the regulatory responsibility to be the oversight for adult homes and assisted living. And then we have the agency to housing portfolio. So on the Medicaid side, we have the issue of diversion waiver program, which we work with our colleagues at DHCR on. It's a housing voucher program. It's in operation since 07. We'll see about 211 participants, average subsidy of about 750. The state general fund, non-Medicaid funded. That's a specific voucher program for people that are in that Medicaid waiver. We also have the GPI housing subsidy, which is a housing subsidy that goes with people who are going to the TBI waiver as well. And that has a little bit more involved, started in 95. It has about, to the numbers of participants here, and so a little bit less as far as the number of subsidies. That's operated through a contract with a vendor. In addition, in the Medicaid waiver program, both NHCD, TBI, and the long-term healthcare program of Lombardi waiver, there's this thing called Medicaid Community Transition Services, which is kind of a setup for people when they come out of nursing homes or to set up a household or prevention of people going into nursing homes, which overlaps with some of the local DSS work on the setup of the apartment. In addition, the Money Follows the Person Demonstration Program, which has been in operation since 2006, provides additional federal reimbursements for Medicaid for people who have been in a nursing home for more than 6 months, who are repatriated out of the nursing home into the community, and New York gets additional federal FMAP for those activities. The DOH has a work group, and it's been working with a lot of different agencies on this MFP program. We provide initial startup funding for the housing search, .gov, that the housing agency runs, as well as we have a housing education program with NIO. education program. It's a very unique program with the New York State Association of Independent Living. It really trains people to advocate for people with disabilities in the community to be part of the housing decision-making of that local community, as well as kind of raising general public awareness of housing. The next side of the health department is their work on adult care facilities. As people know them, as adult homes or enriched housing. And this is a regulatory function that was transferred from the Department of Social Services over to the Department of Health. And it's, has a licensure and a surveillance position with it. So an adult care facility is a family, and I won't read that all too many words on that slide. You can look at it on the website. As I said, adult homes and enriched housing. What an adult home is a, as people know, is a residential alternative to for people in need of supervision, not necessarily need the level of care of a nursing home or an enhanced assisted living, but it's a base residential care, and it operates across the state. It looks very different across the state. And enriched housing is an old model, which is still very relevant today, which is more of an apartment-type model, which is part of the adult care facility. Assisted living program was enacted way back in 1991, and it built on the adult home or enriched housing base, and it combines home care with an adult home, and also has a Medicaid rate established with it. So it's a Medicaid payment for health or assisted living program for people in need of that medical services, but not quite in need of residential care in a nursing home. Chapter 165. A selective development of housing to a capitated Medicaid payment based on the PRI score. These are the services in the facility program, including your basic personal care, home health services, as well as nursing, social education, and adult daycare to a recognition. Health plus selectives. They also must have a contract with a certified home health agency or local health care program. I see this slide has a lot of acronyms on it, so we'll try to demystify that for further information. But it really is the combination of home care and housing together, the simple theme of this slide. And there are currently 90, almost 100 facilities with a total capacity of 5,600 beds. We're also reviewing additional 45 health programs, and we cover almost the state, not quite the whole state, but 44 counties are covered by health. In 2004, a law was passed establishing assisted living residences, which are really more on the private pay side of assisted living, and it allows both a base assisted living residence as well as an enhanced or special needs assisted living. These allow for the first time the provision of aging in place, so someone could be in an assisted living residence if they have the enhanced certificate and actually be in that home from all the way till the end of life. So these are residential alternatives, non-nursing homes, but with the enhanced certificate allows aging in place all the way to the end of life. The special needs part of the certificate allows for dementia or other type of special needs housing to be included in your assisted living residence. And it really, the model of assisted living residence, it keys off the ISP or the individualized service plan, includes obviously base level services as well as medical services as appropriate for the individual. And then I'm going to whip through this, not the expert on this portfolio, but included in the Department of Health is the AIDS Institute, and they have a very significant housing portfolio as well. So they prepared a number of slides here. So these are, obviously people with HIV or at risk of AIDS or HIV, risk of homelessness or homelessness, diagnosed. And the whole program here is to secure housing and maintain housing. Lines are pretty self-evident. Obviously, the primary goal is to obtain stable housing, low housing retention, and stabilization. This is the last housing program unit solicitation in 2010. Kind of the scope of the contracts and the assistance to for AIDS housing, small part of it. You'll hear more about New York 1, 2, and 3 later. This is our small part of the New York 3 agreement. And these are just some of the objectives and the assistance that the agency gives to contractors in the housing area. As you can see, it's health and independent living skills development, non-intensive case management, some counseling, some other services that are attached to persons with AIDS or HIV. Again, I'll look for the New York Interim 3 part of it, because I'll also do a New York presentation later. And now we move to the OPWD. So, good. We have people from OPWD here to present as well. So that is there's a very quick review of the DOA stuff for growth and housing, and obviously we can provide additional information for you. So we can pause now and take questions. If you have questions on that, I'm going to do it real quick. Before we go to the other interior, we can just write something.
Good afternoon, Secretary of Interior. I'm Jill Tankill for our PWD and the Downstate Associate Commissioner. With me, I have Lucinda Griffin, who is the Director of Housing Initiatives and Support, and we're glad to be kicking off this meeting today with talking about our current services. So just to today's presentation, what we are looking to do is just kind of give you an overview of our residential programs and initiatives as our service delivery system today, and to discuss briefly about our new direction for residential programs, which will be facilitated to our new 1115 waiver, which is a demonstration waiver, which is identified as people first waiver. One of the things before we start is just to talk about OPWD's mission statement. And our mission statement is that we help individuals with developmental disabilities live richer lives. And we do that through helping people that we support reach four outcomes. We want our individuals with developmental disabilities to enjoy meaningful relationships. We want them to with their friends and families and experience personal health and growth. And it's important that they live in the home of their choice, and that they fully participate in the community through work or volunteer. So before we get started, I just wanted to give you an overview of our services in our university. At OPWD, we provide support and services for over 126,000 individuals. In our housing initiative, that is roughly 40,000 people. About 37 of those 1,000 people are in congregate care living, and the remainder are in supported independent living settings such as Home of Your Own, House Sharing, and Person Directed. So I'm going to have Lucinda begin with that part, and then I'll speak up the other issues that we have.
OPWD really started with the Person Controlled Housing around the late 1996, early 2000. Prior to that time, it was not well known that an individual with a developmental disability purchase their own home or live in an apartment independently. So today, it's considered as an anomaly when we think about the Home of Your Own program. But we've been very successful. This program officially started in 1996 with a host of partnerships, starting with the State of New York Mortgage Agency. And from there, we went to M&T Bank. And from M&T Bank, we went to the New York State Housing and Community Renewal. So the platform for OPWD's personal controlled housing is grounded in public-private partnerships. Affordable housing without public-private partnerships, we would not be able to provide. And in addition to the in-state partnerships, we have a strong partnership with federal agencies. OPWD, to this day, remains the only state agency in the nation that's certified or approved by HUD to provide pre- and post-housing counseling to the population. And with that designation, we are able to assist individuals in the transition from group home settings to independent living. Without that transitioning skill, without that pre- and post-home ownership skill, it is extremely difficult for a person to live on his or her own. So today I'm going to briefly touch upon the Home of Your Own program, home sharing, and apartment living, which is as briefly as is the word, because these are really strongly grounded programs. With the home ownership program called FOIA, we have two memoranda of understanding, One is with the New York State Homes and Community Renewal, the State of New York Mortgage Agency, which provides for our population a 4% fixed 30 or 40-year mortgage at 100% financing, very little down payment. And we are also working with M&T Bank in New York State. And then we also have a memorandum of understanding with the United States Department of Agriculture Rural Development, Section 502. Between those two entities, those two agencies, and I'll leave the bank out for a few minutes, between those two agencies, we have at OPWDB more than nearly $25 million in loans to assist people to live independently in their community of choice, which is not to be taken very lightly. From there, the eligible population, individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, their income-eligible parents, our legal guardians, can also apply to us for assistance and now direct support professionals. The last two eligible populations only came on recently in 2007, but individuals with developmental disabilities in our system have been purchasing homes since 1996. Not well known, but it has happened and is currently happening. These are the kinds of assistance we provide to individuals who purchase their own homes or live in their own apartment. And we are able to do this at our agency primarily because we are HUD approved. Without the HUD approval, and what does that mean? We are certified by NeighborWorks America as housing counselors. HUD has awarded OPWDB more than $300,000 to train people at OPWDB to be housing counselors to assist our population. And so with that approval, we are able to do at our agency pre- and post-housing counseling and training. We have an IDA, a match savings program. We received $1 million from the United States Department of Health and Human Services to do a match savings program to help our population save for the down payment on a home. And with the home grant, we were very fortunate to receive approximately $975,000 from the Housing and Community Renewal of New York State through the Research Foundation to assist our population. Recently, during the month of April, we assisted four individuals with down payment assistance, totaling each person approximately $35,000. Tremendous help to homeowners. We at OPWDB provide foreclosure prevention. We do mortgage delinquency, and we do mortgage default programs. We sound as if we are not a state agency, but we are certified to provide foreclosure prevention so that when a person purchases a home and they run into difficulty, M&T Bank sends a notice to OPWDB to say, this person has defaulted on their loan. We call them immediately and provide services. You have to tell me when it's done. We provide credit counseling and credit repair because we have found that the number one issue with our population is either no credit at all or difficulty with credit. So we are trained to provide the credit counseling and credit repair right at OPWDB in the housing office. We do financial management, and recently Commissioner Burke signed a memorandum of understanding with the Capital District Transportation Authority. And that memorandum of understanding will provide homeowners that come through our program with two full years of free bus transportation in addition to training for transportation, because we believe in looking at the whole person is just not enough to buy the house, but we're looking at employment as well as transportation. So that MOU was recently signed, and we work with HRC with the New York Housing Search.gov. That old name is ingrained in my mind. Sorry, I'm sorry.
Okay, moving on.
I mentioned that previously, and I like this distinction because of being the only state agency in the nation with that distinction that was approved by HUD to do housing counseling. Very important for our population, or for any population transitioning from nursing homes, group homes, or what have you. We also have a
quite a bit of individuals, not as much as we want, living in apartments, sharing apartments, because we do provide a housing subsidy, and Joe will talk about it in a few minutes, talking very fast. But the shared room and board cost helps tremendously, primarily because people who don't want to live by themselves, who want to live with a friend that they grew up with, the cost saving for shared room and board cost is just tremendous when you think about it. And then you co-share the staff support, and then you can have even a live-in caregiver in some instances. So all of these initiatives that we have at OCWD when it comes to person-controlled housing are really very cost-effective. Joe gave the numbers. We are looking to expand those numbers through our 1115 waiver. Next slide. Joe will talk about the supports for people who live in their own home or apartment.
I think the initiatives that Lucinda just talked about are really where we're going as far as the strategic direction at OPWDD. We are looking at innovative and how can we support individuals with their families and their communities and without the support within the lives that they are looking for. Predominantly at OPWDD, we have many primary care settings throughout the state, so you know, we're looking for how we can create these other innovative opportunities. And what we have currently that we can help support individuals is our individual support and service program, which helps create the independent settings for individuals where we'll assist a provider agency and that person's partner to help them subsidize their rent. In addition to this rent subsidy, though, we assist in all the housing costs and expenses based on its income base, and it's also both at needs of the individual. Our consolidated supports and services is a direction that we hear from our stakeholders, the individuals with mental disabilities and families, is the direction that they want to go. And that takes the supported housing to the next step, where they're also living where they choose, but they're also directing their services through hiring their staff and making those kind of decisions. Currently, you know, I talked earlier about the 37,000 individuals that we serve in target settings. These are the various types of settings that are typically what we call 24/7, where we're providing supports to the individuals 24/7. And we also have one of our jewels, the family care home. These are a very natural setting where individuals go and will live with a family member and will support them through housing subsidies and as well as supports of staff. So that's pretty much what exists now at OPWD. And as far as our future direction, you know, we talk about the 1115 waiver. We've been working on that for the past, over the summer, I guess the past 4 or 5 months. And clearly the direction that we want to do is take, we know that we have substantial existing housing stock in our system, provide people the services that they need in 24/7 settings. So we want to take a look at our infrastructure and help people who want to move into their own independent settings doing that through what we have in existence. And we also know that out of the individuals that live in those settings, 10% of them it shows us in statistics, are capable of living on their own. We just have to make sure that we provide the safety net so families and individuals with disabilities can take that next step. Through the 1115 waiver, we want to be able to identify the barriers that will give somebody the flexibility to move into housing that is of their choice. And we also want to minimize our reliance on the institutional care in 24/7. And how we do that is taking a look at housing across the state and looking at the models that are out there. One of the things that we also do in our support and independent living that has been successful is we've worked with developers and housing people who fund the housing through integrated housing, where we have set aside for apartments. If somebody's building 142 senior housing, we would partner with that developer to make sure that we were able to have housing for people that we support. So that's critical in our success. In addition, we want to be looking at technology. We want to make sure our waiver rights in how we do remote monitoring for people who don't need that 24-hour support but do need to have that safety net in case of certain circumstances. And we want to be focusing on our person-centered planning voice as well as self-determination. And, of course, you know, future forward of the Clause 15 waiver, we want to make sure we're coordinating our efforts through with the MRC. Thank you very much for letting us speak today.
Okay. Question?
If I could just ask you one factual question. Your HUD housing counseling program, is that only for people who've gone through your home ownership program?
No, we have opened it out to anyone that calls our office. One of the requirements from HUD when we received approval in 2005 is that we should not turn anyone right away. So that if someone calls from the general population for pre- and post-housing counseling, foreclosure prevention, most of our foreclosure prevention individuals that we're working with are not OPWD. So that's what it is.
Do you have targets for moving people from 24/7 care to more independent settings? If you do, over what are those numbers?
Well, actually, that has been how we've been managing our resources over the last few years because of the development and the fiscal crisis that hit us a couple of years ago. We've really been partnering with our providers, which has been ongoing, to really create those opportunities. I think we've been, you know, working with families and providers since 2008 to do that. But the waiver itself is going to encourage that. So a target date, I just want to, it's like ongoing as part of our mission and vision.
I'm going to talk about the mental health housing programs, and then later I believe I'm going to touch on New York now. The Austin Mental Health has been involved in housing since the 1970s. We started with family care and group homes and then licensed departments that get SSI Level 2 funding. In the 90s, we started to move into supported housing. Supported housing was really a red subsidy like Section 8, along with some modest support services. And when we got to New York, we started to develop single room occupancies. Those are buildings that have very small efficiency apartments with front desk coverage, and the individuals can stay there over extended periods. And then in 2000, we started to get more into integrated housing, dealing with other state housing agencies that have people with serious illness integrated into.
Can people see that? Can you turn the lights off?
Okay. You okay? Just a few examples. This is the Times Square Hotel, and we've got 650 people in there. A couple of hundred of them are funded by New York Housing, and there was a lot of capital from partners in there. This is an agency project for renewal. It's on Tilden Avenue in the Bronx, and there's about 63 working on departments in there. We're just giving you examples of what some of the OMH housing looks like. Here's the Cobb Avenue in Brooklyn. In the access. There's 64 units in there, 37 of them serve people with mental illness, and the others are low-income people in general, people with other disabilities and integrated models. The Open Mental Health funds 33,000 units of housing now, and there's another 8,700 in development. And you'll see the ranges that I've already described, the group homes and the apartments, which some of that has Medicaid in it under the Medicaid rehab option, as well as SSI Level 2 to provide the funding, and some deficit funding. If the building, the group home is over 16 units, it's considered IMD and doesn't have Medicaid in it. Family care programs, SROs, supported housing, again, it's like a Section 8 program with some modest supports associated. That's the largest and fastest growing program. That's integrated housing in the community. There's typically not capital associated with it, although sometimes those units fund the rent in a capital building. This shows how the Oakland House developed housing over the years, and you'll see the green line is in the residence program. That program was increasing in the 80s and early 90s, and that's we're not developing that anymore, although there's a lot of those units out there that are very helpful. And we're increasing SRO low-type housing and rent-subsidized supported housing at this point. This really shows part of the impact of housing. That the first chart shows that in 1983 there were 20,000 state psychiatric center beds, and there were about 3,000 units of mental health housing. And as of this year, there are about first chart shows that in 83 there were 20,000 state hospital beds, and now there's about 3,000 state hospital beds, a significant reduction. The other chart shows the increase in housing. In 1983 there were about 4,000 units of housing, and now there's about 33,000 units of housing. So there's lots of reasons why the state hospital census ran down, but one of the significant reasons is that the money is rotated from institutions into community-based housing, this is how the Office of Mental Health develops housing. We work with non-profit organizations. We provide capital dollars and operating funds and rent subsidies to non-profits. Now we're promoting integrated housing. We're trying not to do housing that's only people with mental illness anymore, and we encourage our providers to apply for other housing funds to provide integrated housing. The way the capital works is that the Office of Mental Health provides capital on the front end to the provider to purchase the building and develop it. And we really use the short-term interest stream for that. And the long-term financing is typically used through the DASNY, the Dormitory Authority, or HCR. And when the building is completed and we bond it, the bonding proceeds go to replenish the short-term interest to the account, so that's a rotating fund. And both DAS and HCR require that the Office of Mental Health twice a year make payments to the bond debt. So the Office of Mental Health actually intercepts those funds in the individual project and pays it right off the top to the operators. We have very strong partnerships with the other state housing agencies. As I mentioned, we work closely with DAS on tax-exempt bonds. We also work closely with HCR using their HSA bonding. But more recently, we've got some tax credits. We worked very closely with the Corporation for Supportive Housing for a couple of years where they provided consultation for us to figure out how to use the 4% tax credit. We started to use that in 2007, and now every one of our capital projects has 4% tax credit in it, and that saves the state about 25% on each project. It's been really fantastic in terms of cost effectiveness. Our providers also apply for the competitive 9% credits through HCR, and we have several projects now that have 9% tax credits in it. So mental health housing providers are really expanding into being affordable housing providers. We've had about a 20-year relationship with OCDA, where any application that goes to ODA that has a mental health component to it is reviewed by the State Office of Mental Health. And the State Mental Health Commissioner serves on the HHAC board, and just recently the Mental Health Commissioner was asked to become a voting member of that board, so a very strong working relationship. We also provide operating funds to the services, so that's the support side of supported housing. We provide the property operating funds, and we provide program services. The service funds come from a combination of SSI, supported housing is the living alone SSI amount, and the licensed housing is SSI level 2. Some of the programs have Medicaid in them under the rehab option. There's state aid, and any time we get federal HUD dollars, we get HUD dollars. Just talk a little bit about the benefits of home age housing. If people with serious mental illness have a lot of stigma. They have a lot of trouble getting access to lots of things, and the fact that the Office of Mental Health has funds to buy housing really gets people with mental illness to the table in the area of affordable housing. We've worked very hard over the years to make our funding very flexible, so sometimes it's the first dollar in where providers go with a mental health commitment and get other capital because the donations make capital available. Sometimes it's the last dollar in to make a deal work, so we're able to use it to fill gaps. There's guaranteed operating cash flow both on the capital side and on the rent subsidy side. So it really, lots of times, it increases the application's credit worthiness. If you have a building with 100 units and 25 of them have only supported housing funding, for example, that's a guaranteed rent subsidy stream. If we have capital involved in the project, the application for strong on this side and the other side. other thing that the budget division likes, that I like, is that through the bond sales, the Office of Mental Health gets a percentage of management fees, and we get about $1.2 million a year of management fees, and that pays for almost all my housing staff. So the housing staff that the Office of Mental Health has is mainly funded through management fees from the bonding of these projects. Okay, and now the next thing I want to talk about is what we're facing now. So that's the housing program. This is really the housing crisis. And what Commissioner Hogan says is that the housing crisis for people with mental illness is really a housing crisis, not a mental health crisis. The largest population on SSI are people with serious mental illness. There's about 200,000 New Yorkers on SSI with mental illness. About 125 of them live downstate. And they're completely priced out of housing. This is what the SSI living normal rate is. It's going up to $785 on January 1st. I don't think we really need to meet if that's happening. So that's what somebody has to live on. So it's no wonder why a high percentage of people that are homeless have mental illness, transinstitutionalization, really talks about what the median price is for a one-bedroom apartment in various areas of the state and what percentage of the SSI check that is. So even in the very, affordable area of Binghamton, 80% of your SSI check would have to be spent just for rent. That's not utilities, that's not food, it's not transportation, or clothing. When you get south of Kingston, it's over 100%. And when you get way down to, say, 163% in the city, 191% in Westchester. When you get downstate, even two people sharing a one-bedroom apartment really can't afford it. This chart, you'll notice it's a chart I showed earlier with the OMH housing development over the past 20 years. That red arrow is from the Furman, the Furman Center's housing and real estate component within NYU, the place of housing market. And there was an article in the New York Times in 2009 said over a five-year period, there were 40,000 units of affordable housing lost in New York City. So basically, all the housing in New York has developed in the past 20 years is quite down. It's because of what's happening with affordable housing in the state. A little bit about the challenges the state faces. There's been ramping up of litigation under the Olmstead law. There was litigation against the state around adult homes. 28 adult homes in the New York City area were identified their quote impacted. In those 28 homes, there were about 4,300 people with serious mental illness. The majority of most of these homes had people with serious mental illness in them. And the state was ordered to offer supportive housing to all those individuals, even though 4,500 units of housing over a 3-year period. The state is appealing that, and it's now on hold. And we haven't heard how the court will decide on that. Just a fact, as I said, SSI living alone is $761. SSI level 3, which is what people get when they move to adult homes, is $1,368. So people partially move that direction because the policy is that there's more funding available in those settings. There was, following the adult home litigation, there was nursing home litigation. Again, there are a number of people in nursing homes where the plaintiffs indicated they felt that their own civil rights were being violated. The state was able to settle that just very recently, just about a month ago. And we're moving forward to a settlement, mainly a cost associated with that. So what can we do right now? We're saying that the Office of Mental Health should continue to develop housing both with rent subsidies and capital for the reasons that I've laid out. We should continue to collaborate with the other state agencies to do integrated housing. There really should be set aside for any housing development. For a while at the federal level, we were talking about the Low Income Housing Trust Fund. I don't know if that has liability anymore, but I do think the state should be advocating with the federal government to meet their responsibilities. We've gotten very good around litigation around Olmstead at the same time that the federal government is backing away from helping states with affordable housing. We should continue to leverage other resources, consumer resources. A lot of the housing providers now have a lot of equity in the properties. They've had it for a long time, and they're using creative ideas around that. And there are certain approaches about looking at a whole neighborhood and trying to get a community focus on housing preservation. I think Times Square Hotel is an early example there when New York City was trying trying to really turn around Times Square. I think on the ground, for example, at a couple of areas that we are speaking now, we're focusing on neighborhoods. Two things that aren't on here that I wanted to mention. We should also be looking at Medicaid, and any time there's an opportunity for Medicaid to help with the support, we should go in that direction. The federal government is looking at a partnership between HUD and CMS, and we think we should pursue that. And finally, we should really be targeting housing. When I talk about New York later, I'll talk about if you're going to develop the housing, you're going to have to target it to make sure it's going to people when you get it, or you're not maximizing the resource.
Questions for Bob? You're going to stay until the end. Okay, you'll stay to the end?
Yes.
Any questions?
Okay. I'm Bill Panafin, I'm the Director of Housing Services at Oasis. I've been working in homeless housing since 1985. Much of that focused in here in New York City, but also upstate. And what we've been trying to do in the last 4 or 5 years is actually also do a rural initiative program as well and look at that impact. So I'm going to focus primarily on what we've done in New York City and in the larger cities upstate. We believe at Oasis that permanent supported housing is absolutely integral to successful long-term recovery from addiction for individuals and for families. The reason we emphasize families as well as individuals is about a third of our population in permanent supported housing are families with an average of 3 kids. So we think that this is also a wonderful opportunity to break some of the multi-generation cycles of addiction, trauma, and a whole range of other issues. So access to safe, affordable housing, clearly with a long-term rental subsidy, a stable living wage in terms of employment, as well as clearly a personal recovery plan. The reason we've tied the living wage employment piece to the housing is that the vast majority, over 80% of the people who come to us homeless with addiction problems and co-occurring psychiatric problems, trauma issues, don't meet SSI threshold, don't have serious, persistent, long-term mental illness issues, but have long histories of co-occurring. Therefore, they're primarily public assistance recipients, either safety net or TANF. And so we put, since 2007, the capacity to do job development, job placement, post-employment support into the hands of our housing providers. And that has worked really well, and I'll cover that as we move forward. But I just really wanted to tie that together, and that's why we see the focus on living wage employment as well as the housing. Significant number of homeless people come into the Oasis treatment system. 4,000 a year enter our programs, primarily our long-term residential programs, close to 3,000 in New York City. Clearly the interface in terms of homeless people who are single adults coming into shelter, pretty close to 50% have significant addiction issues, 25% of single women, and 25% of heads of households in terms of homeless families. Again, statewide, the homelessness addiction interaction cuts across city, suburbs, rural communities. In terms of our local mental hygiene planning process, 31 counties just this past summer identified permanent supported housing as a major, major service priority. It's clearly not just a New York City issue. Oh, all these little purple bullets, and you probably can't see them all. we're looking at the kinds of housing grants that we do, and just want to touch on, let me just say that we've done Shelter Plus Care programming since the 1993-94 in partnership with HUD, and that's across the state. New York 3 we've done since 07-08. Permanent supported housing upstate is literally just an attempt to modify New York 3 model and make it apply to cities like Buffalo and also some of the smaller communities. We did a little piece of reentry housing with Parole and Fortune Society. And then the homeless prevention piece is really brand new. We just started over the summer. We have leveraged federal substance abuse program monies in three communities, in Brooklyn, in Rochester, and in two rural counties upstate, Delaware and Otsego, to do a two-month either rental arrears or a first month deposit, security deposit, first month rent, some utility arrears in order to prevent homelessness. We're going to focus about $1 million out of a total $3 million federal grant for the homelessness prevention. That we project that will prevent evictions in about 200-250 households in Brooklyn, 200-250 in Rochester, another 50 in small rural communities. It's our first attempt to look at addressing working poor and to look at addressing homelessness prevention. It's really patterned after the successful program that OTPA used with ARRA money over the last couple of years in terms of homelessness prevention. And it's just to build on that and to focus it down in terms of people with special needs. We're really excited about that piece. Where is our housing? As you can see, a significant amount of our supported housing is in New York City. The lion's share of that, in 2007, we had about 425 units, apartments, shelter plus care through HUD, and nothing else in New York City. We now have 325 units for single adults with New York 3. We're about to do an RFP very, very soon to do our first 75 family homeless units through New York 3 and a little piece of reentry. Long Island, very, very difficult. Mid-Hudson, a little bit easier. As you can see, a limited number, less than 150 units in Metro New York, if you will. We've done pretty well upstate, as you can see, almost 500 units. Much of it, the lion's share, is again with HUD and Shelter Plus Care. The 47 permanent supported housing upstate is 100% state money. In some ways, a very modest analogy, if you will, to New York 3. Just the dots, the stars, what counties we're in. 4 years ago, we were in 11 counties plus New York City. We're now in 22 counties plus New York City. So we're certainly expanding this kind of an important effort. It's working. It's working. Our Shelter Plus Care long-term program, our New York 3 program, and Bob is going to speak more to that in a broader context. There you go, 113%. How can you do 113% occupancy? This is the tie of employment and permanent supported housing. If you're contracted for 100% and 90% is really great occupancy, but you start to get the adults working and then their contribution of 30% gross monthly income is more than the home relief allowance, is more than ultimately more than an SSI allowance. And therefore, we don't take that money back as a net deficit budget procedure. We allow the voluntary to keep the money generated by the clients for their successful employment and growth. So there's an internal growth. There's a naturalistic growth to these programs. And the agencies rent beyond their contracted amount. That's why it's 113% occupancy. And why is it 130% upstate and so much higher? Because the rents are cheaper. And as Bob related earlier, if a one-bedroom apartment in Binghamton is $600, but it's $1,400 here in New York City, you know, if you do the math in terms of what you can do in terms of a living wage. So
But overall, we're just doing really, really very, very pleased with tying employment into the permanent housing piece, not separating it out. Okay, we are doing good retention. Only 17% stay less than 6 months after placed in our housing. 37% are staying 6 to 24 months. Another 46 staying more than 2 years. The reason the 37% isn't 10% or 15% and the staying more than 2 years isn't higher is the, again, the effect of our having roughly 500 apartment units upstate so that people get a full-time job, save a little money, and then you go out and live independently and pay $600 a month for their rent. You can't do that down here. And so the difference between how many people stay 2 years or more downstate versus upstate is significant. These are statewide averages. That's what we'll find. The last dot point here, though, I really want to emphasize, leavers, people who walk out the door, don't stay in the permanent housing. 11, this is a sample of over 1,000 people we just surveyed in August. 11 leave in the first 2 months. 130 left after 1 year, and again, most of that 130 was upstate, and it was a positive leaving for fully independent, unsubsidized living. So the program really works. Okay, economic development drivers, 33% of our population living in our permanent square housing are employed, another 15% attending college full-time. That's almost there. That's, in terms of a national average, that's really like that. It's really good. That's for sure. I'm going to skip that. That's in the piece.
In terms of people who are active users in terms of housing, is there any differentiation in terms of the different levels of housing that you mentioned?
Sure. And again, this gets back to, very much back to New York Three. Lessons learned from 6 or 7 moving forward. The one population, adult single with substance abuse, primary substance abuse issues, with co-occurring disorders, we made a dichotomy initially, the state and the city, and we decided to do a dichotomy, active users and treatment, quote, treatment completers. In May of 07, when my agency created a housing bureau and brought me back from retirement to go do it, we made some significant changes. Instead of looking at treatment completers as people who had done a year or 18 months in long-term residential and then were essentially rewarded into permanent housing, we said, if you live in a shelter and you've gone and registered in the neighborhood outpatient clinic and you registered 3 months ago, you're going to be a treatment, early treatment person. We bring you into the, quote, treatment side. It's worked wonderfully. In the other side, and the Columbia University study that was just published over the summer in July, interviewed 350 people who were, quote, active users. And what the folks told the interviewers were 70% of them said, well, I was doing drugs actively. I was drinking an awful lot. As soon as I got into that permanent housing, that clean, safe housing, and I could call a case manager, sometimes I didn't want him there, but when I wanted him, he came. 70% of those individuals, the quote active users, said, you know what, I've either stopped or dramatically reduced my intake, my volume of alcohol and other substances. And oh, by the way, 30% of the active users, when they entered the housing, were already in substance abuse treatment. So what that means is, really what you're getting at, I think, is it's one population. And certainly moving forward, whatever we want to do moving forward, we target a population with a significant amount of use of inpatient psychiatric and detox and emergency room and all the rest. We want to do one population. No more than the cop. Okay?
Yeah, thanks.
Good afternoon. OTDA is the state agency, see if I can get these going, yes, which serves impoverished individuals and families, many of whom are homeless. We have what's called a state supervised, locally administered system of social services, meaning that local counties are responsible for paying for emergency shelter in the state, and we supervise them in doing that, and also ultimately pay either through CANIS or safety net assistance for the shelter. And in addition, OTDA direct response program that prevents or addresses homelessness. We use a continuum care model in doing that. As you can tell, the most important part, we believe, is homelessness prevention. We do fund a number of programs that address homelessness prevention, but we think that those programs, that is critical. As I said, we supervise emergency shelter. We also fund some transitional housing. And I know that recently, I think those of us who've been working in homelessness for a long time have questioned the necessity of transitional housing. Most of us want to move people right off the street into permitted housing, or from emergency shelter, at least, into permanent or permanent supportive housing. But we do think there's still some populations that may benefit from transitional housing, among them victims of domestic violence, runaway and homeless youth, some veteran population. And what we find is if they have transitional housing, they may be able to go into permanent housing instead of permanent supportive housing, which, of course, is permanent housing with ongoing support. Clearly, most homeless individuals and families do not need to be in permanent supportive housing. There's a subset of the homeless population, though, that will not remain safely housed unless permanent supportive housing is provided. In supervising emergency shelter, we do two things. As I said, we supervise shelters. We also certify them, and we do yearly inspections of the facilities to make sure that they meet our standards. And as I said, we provide funding for their operation. At any given time, you can see Bob was talking about having a housing crisis in blue. The same thing is happening in homelessness. So at any given time, there's about 46,000 homeless individuals receiving emergency shelter in New York State. You can see the breakdown between families and homeless single adults. And I should say that that we think that a little more than a fifth of those homeless individuals are upstate. The rest are in New York City, but it's still a sizable amount upstate. These give you the statistics. As you've seen, there's been, unfortunately, homelessness has been growing since 2008. You see the rapid growth in single adults in both New York City and in rest of the state, as well as homeless families. Particularly, there's been a fair amount in the city, but a notable growth in homeless families in rest of the state as well. And unfortunately, we think, at least for the near future, this is going to continue to increase. The first reason is homelessness is a lagging indicator, meaning that most people try to do everything, not to lose their housing. And they'll get to the place where that's their last resource that they're getting rid of. So we do think that there's a lag. The second thing that's very important is the end of the Homelessness Prevention and Rapid Rehousing Program, which the RP is still talking about, which has a $140 million allocation from HUD, stimulus-funded program to the state, that's just now running out. And if you remember that continuous care model, homelessness prevention is really important. And without the funding for that, even though we have some state funding, frankly, it's a drop in the bucket compared to the $140 million that we're losing. And the other thing I just wanted to briefly mention is that homelessness upstate, I think, will really, is going to be a result of Hurricane Irene and Tropical Storm Lee. The infrastructure in many upstate communities has been totally destroyed. And there's just no rental units to move people to. So it's going to be, I think, a big problem. OCDA provides transitional permanent supportive housing through HHAP, the NYSHA program, and HOPWA, and I'm going to tell you about each one of those programs. HHAP was the first program that we know of in the country that targeted substantial financial resources to homeless housing. It's governed by the Homeless Housing Assistance Corporation that Bob mentioned, which is a public authority that is housed at OTDA and staffed by OTDA staff. As many people have mentioned, we work with our partners, with HCR, OMH, and OASIS on our board. Like OMH, the Dormitory Authority plays a large role. We contract with them to oversee our construction. We have three different kinds of housing that's funded by HHAP. Emergency shelter, transitional housing, and permanent supportive housing. You might, these days, building new emergency shelters has been too popular. And I've talked about transitional housing sort of being, for many people, an outdated model. But I will tell you that in many areas of New York State, there still is a need for emergency shelter. Fewer than half of the counties in the state actually have emergency shelters for homeless people. In the other counties, they use hotels or motel stays, and I can tell you upstate, this is becoming a big burden on counties. So in terms of permanent supportive housing, I wanted to talk, just highlight before we go through and look at the different kinds of populations we serve in each three of those three categories we just talked about, what I think sort of has been the areas that we pioneered in. First is housing for persons living with HIV/AIDS. From the very beginning of the AIDS epidemic, HHAP paid for housing for people with HIV and AIDS. The second is in low-demand housing for chronically homeless persons, not just in New York City, but there's some really good upstate projects that have housing retention rates far in excess of 85%. And this is for people that sometimes have been living on the street for 20 or 30 years before coming to the housing. Another area, which we've been innovative, is reentry housing for former inmates. And the fourth is smaller-scale supportive housing programs for homeless individuals and families. We fund a lot of programs in partnership with other agencies in New York City, but oftentimes in upstate, we're the only funder of the program. Upton Foundation is fundraising money. Because of there are a number of projects that can't be built with tax credit, the financing just won't work. So that's one of our specialties. In terms of eligibility, again, you can see the people that are eligible to do buildings. For us, it's not like OMH, not for profit, and also municipalities and public corporations. The eligible activities are acquisition, construction, and rehabbing of housing, and for people who are homeless who are otherwise be homeless without HHAP. Again, homeless single adults, homeless youth and families, many of them have specific life challenges, and all of them are poor. All of them have incomes of 30% or less than the average median income for that area. So the people we're serving are extremely poor people. Emergency shelter populations, as you can see, one interesting thing is that the State Office of Children and Family Services is actually the state agency that regulates emergency shelter for victims of domestic violence and for homeless youth. But the HHAP program pays for the construction of those projects, of many of those projects. In the transitional housing populations that we talked about, and permanent supportive housing. And among the populations we haven't mentioned until now are elders and persons with physical disabilities, homeless people that have those characteristics. You can see our existing portfolio is about $785 million. From HHAP's inception in 1983, a total of 13,777 units, with even more beds than we have right now. We've funded 571 contracts. We have more in the hopper. We've got 33 projects that are under development, totaling over 100 million. And that will produce 1,000 new housing units with almost 1,500 in this. Our latest round, we funded 12 projects for almost $29 million. And you can see that the investment in HHAP has leveraged about $175 million. These are our funding partners. I should say in New York City, actually our most common funding partner is HPD. Followed closely by HCR, and as Bob said, we work collaboratively with OMH and OASA, and then there's other private sources of funding. In terms of operating money, HUD has, especially its continuous care homeless assistance program, is a major source of operating funds. And one thing I might mention here is that HUD is very careful in the continuous care program to confine its funding to people that are not coming out of institutions but have come from the street or emergency shelter. So it's sometimes difficult if something is funded with HUD continuum of care money to use that for populations that are coming out of treatment or out of correctional facilities or mental health treatment. Asset management is very important to us. We carefully invest in not-for-profit agencies, but we know that they're serving among the hardest to serve people. So we make sure that we inspect the properties on a regular basis, that we get at least annual reports, if not more frequently, about how the programs are operating, and that we're ensuring that the people that are supposed to be served by the program are being served by the program, that the property is in good shape and meets their needs, and also we're available when things go wrong. And when you're serving this population in this economic climate, a lot of things could go wrong. So that's something that we provide on an ongoing basis. To give you an example, the recent floods in Binghamton wiped out two major supportive housing projects, and we were on the spot helping them get back going, fixing the elevator so people could live there, fixing the heating system, those kinds of things, because once we make the investment, we think it's really important to preserve that investment. Another side of supportive housing programs we provide funding for is that we fund the supportive services portion of permanent supportive housing projects. And everything we do is focused at maintaining housing stability. So this NYSHIP program, the New York State Supportive Housing Program, is a combination of two programs that you might know about, the SRO program and SHPIA, the Supportive Housing for Families and Young Adults program. We have a recent procurement of $20.4 million. We think it'll serve about 6,500 people. But I want to talk just a minute about the services that are funded by NYSHIP, because they're not the kind of services that are funded typically by Medicaid that fund treatment. Rather, they fund 24-hour program staff, so there's always a staff present, security staff, which especially in the city, a major issue, front desk security, housing-based case management, meaning disputes between tenants, difficulty, for example, arrearages, and how does that happen? What can we do to make sure that you're able to pay? Life skills training, not just budgeting, but again, conflict resolution, those kinds of services, and linkages to employment and benefits. So these services, I think, are essential to retaining the housing. But they're not the kind of services that are paid for. We're not talking treatment services. We're talking about housing-related services. It's not on this slide, but the other thing that I think most of us who do this sort of housing know is that operating costs, paying for the heat and food and snow removal and those kinds of things are really essential to keeping properties maintained and really serving homeless people. The third program that we have, a supportive housing program we have, is the Housing Opportunities for Persons with AIDS. This is a HUD-funded program that goes to large localities, entitlement areas, but we have the balance of state funding for this. Last fiscal year, we got $1.9 million. You can see that we provided long-term rental subsidies, short-term rental subsidies, and operating costs for congregate housing. And I wanted to echo what both Bob and Bill said about the importance of rental subsidies. Papua is a great illustration of a place. HUD paid for the rental subsidies. That we're able to cobble together case management from the AIDS Institute and from Ryan White funding, and it's a very cost-effective program that makes use of existing rental stock. So in summary, our supportive housing is part of this larger continuum of addressing the needs of homeless individuals and families. We work in collaboration with other agencies, both on the state level and federal and city. And our focus is keeping people stable and housed. As many speakers before me have said, we believe that housing stability is sort of curative in itself, that it's sort of essential to people to maintaining their health, their mental health, and their quality of life. That's it. Any questions?
Maybe switch the order and have housing community renewal go first, and I'll mess up the slides. But is that okay? All right. For those you don't know, supportive housing is just one of a number of priorities that we have at HDR.
priorities include not only the financing and development of various forms of multifamily housing, including workforce housing, elderly housing, family housing, culture, but it also includes the regulation of the slum portfolio, as well as the administration of the state and a rent regulation program. Despite the many commitments we have at the HC, we're delighted at our really incredible progress we've made in financing the support of housing since 2008. And there are approximately three categories we really want to talk about today. First and foremost is our largest effort, the development of a new housing unit, which includes our capital and tax credit program. The second category is accessibility modifications under our Access to Home program. And category three are programs that provide rental assistance, including the Nursing Home Transition and Diversion Waiver Housing Program and the HUD-VASH or Veterans Affairs Supportive Housing Program. HDR encourages the supportive housing through a number of efforts in our processing. In 2008, HDR created a set aside of over $2 million in tax credits that generates approximately $20 million in equity investment in supportive housing projects. Since that time, HDR has consistently awarded more than double that amount of that set aside to competitively selected projects across the state. HDR is also a signatory to New York, New York 3 and has strongly prioritized New York, New York 3 applications since its inception. In 2011, we increased the number of New York, New York 3 awards by 260%. And finally, we want to talk a little bit about how we boost our capital and credit programs. We allow increased rating and ranking and project scores. We allow some allowance for increased costs of development support housing. In order for a supportive housing application to be a feasible project, it must include funding from all required costs. HDR's underwriting only recognizes the development and operating costs of the real estate, i.e. the bricks and mortar, in determining the amount of funding needed for the viability of the real estate development and operation. HDR policy requires that supportive housing projects provide for separate funding of any social services required in connection with the project and identifies the rental subsidy source if necessary. That's why we need our state agency partners here today. I want to turn the next part of the presentation over to Sean Fitzgerald.
Great, thanks, Mike. As you see, I'm responsible for managing our multi-family program. These are often programs that are most familiar with supportive housing communities and really provide the vast majority of money that we provide for supportive housing. This chart lists the available resources that announced as part of our 2011 funding round. As you can see from the chart, all of our resources are vastly oversubscribed. For every dollar of funding we make available, there's at least $3 in demand for that subsidy. As such, it's critical that we rely on our competitive rating and ranking on selecting our project. As Mike said earlier, we provide significant points incentives for the housing projects that really give them a leg up in our competition. What really is critical, and I think what's unique about HDR and the group of the state agencies that are here this afternoon, is that we don't really provide any expertise on services. We simply are a bricks and mortar agency. And as such, it's critical that we rely on partners in developing supportive housing. And as this graphic shows, we really rely in three ways on our partners, both state agencies and nonprofits. First of all, as I said, we don't provide any services. We do not know what appropriate services are for the populations we serve. We rely on OASIS, OTDA, OMRDD, there it is, OPWDD, and other state agencies to provide that expertise. Operating, as Linda said, snow removal, electricity, the cost of operating, maintaining affordable housing is made more difficult for supportive housing because of the low-income nature of many of the population that we're serving. And finally, given what I showed previously, the vast oversubscribed description of our resources, we do expect that our associated partners bring capital resources to the table. Using that model of supportive housing development, we've had incredible success. And I dare say that multifamily program, HCR's commitment to supportive housing is stronger than it has been at any time in the agency's history. Just this year, compared to last year alone, 52% increase in supportive housing is funded. A 249-unit increase in New York 3 unit funded, more than 200% increase year over year. And this is largely because of OMH providing New York 3 subsidy that had not been available for a number of years. In fact, we partnered with OMH, we partnered with OMH in our most recent funding round, making available New York 3 subsidy as part of our procurement. They OMH piggybacked on our procurement. As a result, you can see a significant increase in New York 3 units. And overall, 538 units funded in 2011 for persons with special needs. That's about a quarter of the units that we funded in 2011. So a tremendous year. Well, when miles broken, we really do grind to a halt. We can't provide supportive housing without someone providing us the services that populations that we need. The operating subsidy that put in to make the units work, and without the capital that we need in order to stretch our limited resources. In 2009, due to the state fiscal crisis, one of our partners unfortunately had to pull out capital assistance that he had targeted to projects upstate. And because we had fully committed all of our soft subsidy dollars, we were unable to save the project, and as a result, the project did not go forward. So it's really critical that we have all components in order to move forward. I'd like to highlight a couple of case studies of projects that we've had those successful partnerships in. Rochester Avenue Apartments in Brooklyn. This project just opened its doors about a month ago. It's a partnership with Concern for Independent Living, a not-for-profit provider based in Long Island, I believe. We did 65 units of supportive housing for chronically homeless persons with persistent mental illness. Service funding from New York City OMH, New York 3, operating subsidy, New York 3 OMH. And this is a great example of partnering on capital resources. OMH through a CPC supported loan provides $12.7 million towards the brick and mortar project. HDR resources provide $10.4 million. Great project. Next case study is Cadence Square, the project we just funded as part of our 2011 funding round, Santa Canandaigua, Ontario County. The partnership with a not-for-profit casualty recovery system based out of Erie County. Total of 22 supportive units, 33 total units. Population served as veterans in long-term recovery. So this is a tremendous example. And new OASA is a licensed service provider providing services to the project. OTA, Congress Care Funding, helping us meet the operating project. And OASA, the Homeless Housing Assistance Corporation, partner with HCR to help meet the brick and mortar needs of the project. Also, I should note that the VA contributed the land for the project. This was one of the projects that really, we think, showcases our efforts to work collaboratively with agency to create supportive housing opportunities. So that sort of circles back. That's the end of our presentation. Any questions?
Okay, thanks. We're obviously getting time challenged here. I'll leave it to you. I'm going to stay here at 4:30 to have the room and try and finish the presentation. You have some commitments, we'll understand, and make the additional information available to you directly, and as I indicated, we'll be on the website. Bob, with that, maybe we could go through your slides a little bit more quickly than otherwise.
desirable.
When we did this, Deputy Mayor Gibbs was actually the commissioner of the Department of Homeless Services.
demonstrate that the single homeless problem wasn't just a mental health problem, it was a problem with individuals with a range of disabilities. So in New York 3, it wasn't targeted against mental health, it was targeted to a range of disabilities. And I think in the presentation today, we've heard various agencies talking about New York 3. So population A and B were for people with serious mental illness. There were two substance abuse populations, I think. Oasis Bill talked about housing for people that were in treatment and housing for people that were still using. There was HIV housing. There were two targets for young adults, people coming out of psychiatric centers, but also people that left foster care. There's a lot of national data showing within a couple of years of people leaving foster care, a very high percentage of people drift into homelessness, unfortunately. And there was also a family focus, families that had a family member that had a mental illness, substance abuse, or HIV member. Because of that, it was a much more complex rule to negotiate to implement each of the state partner agencies. And actually, they're all represented here today. And these are the New York City partner agencies, both capital development and operating agencies. I'm not going to go into detail here, but this is the amount of housing that was allocated to various populations. This is showing you in the handout. And what I want to make here is that with the mental health housing, the president was saying that the city was split the capital and the state was on the operating cost. That's how New York 2 was done. But for the newer populations, the state and city did went 50-50 on both the capital and the operating dollars. So the city was providing some of the operating costs for the population. To date, we have about 3,678 of these units operational. We have all the supported housing options, and the capital, as we all know, comes up slowly. You have to find buildings, you have to go through the community approval, you have to get the capital, you have to do the renovation. So there's about 1,000 units going in. And a high percentage of the rest are acquired and under development. Are on their cycles of connecting capital and operating, and Mike just talked about the success we got this year in a blended application. But what I wanted to say is we intentionally front-loaded this with supported housing because we needed to get a big bang. So we put the rent subsidies out there right away, and we got that on the street. Now, these next two slides come from my friend George Nyshek, who's the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Homeless Services in charge of single adult homeless issues, so to speak, and shelter. And this goes years away. If you look at the right hand corner, this is how it's targeting shelters. We targeted the long stay shelter population, the people that had to be in shelter at least a year over the past 2 years. In 06, there were, out of all the shelter beds, in those single beds, 1,337 of them were long stay populations. And in 2010, that's down to 629. So, partly through the New York Initiative targeting this population, we freed up about 700 long stay beds. And what that means is instead of a bed being filled by the same person year after year, it's freed up and several people can be served in that. So, for a while, before the economy went down, the city was actually able to close the shelters while still serving the same number of people. And if you look at the declines year by year, in 2007 and 2008, when the New York housing was coming on fast because of the apartments, there was a significant reduction in the long stay people in the single shelters and it's level off now. The second one talks about street homeless. It comes from the Hope Survey. And over a 5-year period, there's about a 40% reduction in street homeless. And George attributes this partially to New York work and partially to the state payment. So, again, Department of Homeless Services is saying it's steepest declines in the long stay population in the shelters and on the street came when the New York housing was coming up quickly. Yeah, New York are going to
thanks, Bob. So, to round out the presentation of information today, we've asked Ed Howden, one of the workforce members here, give us sort of the agency perspective on this, and then we can use 2 minutes to get the observations of the team members.
Okay, thanks. Just want to say on the way over here, our elevator in our building has a video screen with a news feed, and one of the articles was that some states are restricting Medicaid payments for only the first 10 days of hospitalization and then leaving people on their own. And I just want to say thank you for not doing that and just going to such a collaborative process to try to get us out of this situation. We really do appreciate the effort you guys have made to try to figure out how to do this in a more proactive, more progressive, and constructive way. This is somewhat of a thankless task. I've got a bunch of experts, and I will say things that probably government will say disagree with, and some of my providers may disagree with, and I might get my numbers wrong, but I'll do my best here. Bear with me. So supportive housing, just very quickly, we're talking about it because it does reduce Medicaid costs. It reduces a lot of different costs. On average, about a 60% reduction in inpatient and emergency department costs when you place people with supportive housing. Those cost savings vary a lot, depending if you're serving high-cost groups like HIV/AIDS, chronic homelessness. The fact is that this is something of a happy accident. We were really looking to end homelessness, and in fact, we found out that we were also reducing healthcare costs. There's a couple of two-pager information things, overview of the various studies that have happened, and also Housing Works provided a briefing paper that has some very good information on the overview of that. The things that supportive housing also does, though, are important as well. It does decrease homelessness. It serves many other high-cost populations that might not show up as high-cost users of Medicaid, including ex-offenders, families reunited with foster care, youth leaving institutional or foster care, domestic violence victims, veterans. These are important. It also strengthens communities because we often are the first building on the block, and then other private development follows, and you can see that all over New York City. It improves children's educational life outcomes, which really pays off over the long term, and integrates people with disabilities. I think it's very important to integrate. We have to integrate people into the community, and that means mixed models of housing. It also provides entry-level employment for a lot of people that don't often get access to that. It works for a whole variety of reasons, but, I mean, it really comes down to flexibility. We are allowed to be very flexible in trying to deliver a person-centered care that really makes the difference in that people are invested in their own success. And sometimes you're working very intensively with somebody, and sometimes you're not seeing them for a while. They are tenants first. The services are not mandatory, and we have to work with them on their terms. And that turned out to make us much better at working with them and got much better success. Here's an overview of the permanent housing that's in New York State. This does not include transitional units that an emergency shelter, transitional housing, emergency shelter units by OTDA. It does not include licensed transitional housing from OMH, but it gives you a view. We have about 43,000 units of supportive housing. About half of those are mental health units, another 14% for people living with HIV/AIDS, 3% for OASAP, and about all the rest are homeless populations, many of which have some of those co-occurring disorders. There's a lot of overlap. All of these different agencies around the table have paid for this, including a lot of New York City agencies. You can see in New York City, unlike the other counties, there are many more congregate units that we built with capital funding than scattered site. The other regions, there's more scattered site than congregate because there's really a lack of housing now. And these numbers, just for you experts out there, we included CRSROs, the OMH licensed housing model, because that's a more permanent model than their community residence, than apartment treatment. I want to say New York State leads the nation in supportive housing, and it's really due to the leadership of a lot of the people around this table. That said, we are building less supportive housing. Been going down a little bit over the last few years, despite the best efforts of everybody. The fact is we are being hit by the economic crisis and various things have happened. So it's a trend I hope we're going to be able to reverse. Federal home dollars are down 10% this last year. We're facing cuts as much as 38% in the current budget negotiations. OMH Capital is funding has been frozen since 2009. Really job one for this work group probably is to try to get that capital funding unfrozen. I'm not sure how much it is, but it's over $100 million. OTBA, HHAP, and HCR Housing Trust Fund have been flat funded since about 1994, about $30 million and $29 million each, except for a couple of bumps in 2002-2008. Supportive housing receives less than 20% of the annual HDR capital and private equity. This is not by any fault of HDRs. I think that it's really there's a lot of different constituencies that are looking for funding from HDR, and there have valid needs as well. And a lot depends on whether or not projects are viable. But it's at 20%. By comparison, HDB funds uses about 30% of their tax credits to fund supportive housing. The fact is acquisition costs, labor costs, material costs, and other development costs are all rising. They continue to rise even in the economic downturn. Take a look at New York, New York 3 production. I think will give us a little bit of a view, a perspective on this. My staff caught that 7,250 new capital units. It's really 6,250, as Bob said, but I didn't get the change in there. My fault. We are behind in our production. There's a lot of factors that come into that. But congregate capital development is about 57% behind schedule. The city and the state are about even. They're both behind. Scatter site units opened on schedule, and actually we've got a lot more than we had planned. We were planning on 2,750. There's actually 2,941 out there because providers have been able to find efficiencies and rent apartments and really spread those dollars as thinly as they can to get those out there. But the fact is we're about 30% behind schedule, something that we should try to figure out ways to make that happen. As Bob said, the scatter site came on very quickly. That's important. And then the capital has been a little bit slower, the development. Some of the lessons learned from the New York 3, I would say that you need to appropriate enough capital resources to achieve the unit production target. It's very simple. But the fact is that we want flexibility, and the city and the state both need that flexibility to figure out how to use the federal dollars and that sort of thing. But we really got to make sure that we've got enough money. HHAP, for instance, is supposed to build 100 units a year, but they only have funding to build about 68 units a year in New York City. And so there's really no way they can make their targets unless we are able to get more funding. Both scatter site rentals and new capital congregate units are really important. We can't just rent our way out of this. There's a 2.9% vacancy rate in New York, but for units that cost $700 a month or less, it's less than 1% vacancy rate. We want to target resources to most vulnerable. Like Bob said, it went to New York 3 went to the chronically homeless, and the providers embraced it, and it really has paid off as those statistics from the Department of Homeless Services showed in the reduction in chronic homelessness individuals in the shelter. I think we also need to engage and integrate with other needy populations and other affordable housing development efforts. Right now, HPD Supportive Housing Loan Program builds it for New York, and the state really depends on OMH development. We really need to take a look at other affordable housing dollars and figure out how we can integrate with those and get more units out of those. Lastly, I think if we strengthen feedback and planning mechanisms, we can do some mid-course corrections that really will help us do. For instance, family supportive housing, capital development of it has really lagged because nobody was really planning on a program to create those family supportive housing. The youth model for supportive housing has run into some bumps, and we're trying to figure out how to make that program work better. But that's one of the things we could learn from this experience. Some of the development challenges that we're facing now, and these are not criticisms by any means, and I'm going to try not to make it sound like whining. It's just things we need to look at. In the new way, that the way that we used to develop was you would go to OMH and say, I've got a piece of land, and they would give you the money, and you buy the land. Then they would give you the money to build the housing, and then when you built it, you would get money to operate and provide services there. We have gotten much more sophisticated, and we've been able to draw down tax credits and other private equity, but it's much more complex. And what's happened is that nonprofit developers are assuming much, much more risk in that they buy land and then they have to go through a competitive round and try to get the funding for the development. A lot of times the application process does not guarantee the service and operating costs. We've got to figure out ways to allow the nonprofits some backup to assume that risk and share that risk, and at the same time use these creative ways of financing. We did a survey a couple years ago. The top three barriers to development that providers found were that suitable sites are difficult to find and secure. That's true for all affordable housing developers these days. Land is very expensive in downstate New York. NIMBYism, the fact is that 39% of supportive housing providers reported abandoning sites because of community resistance. 53% changed populations or reduced the number of supportive units in a project, and 53% avoid specific community boards because they know they're never going to get them cited. We've got to figure out a way to make communities understand that this is not a bad thing coming to their neighborhood, and at the same time back up the development to make sure it happens. We've been able to prove that property values actually increase and higher and faster the closer you are to supportive housing because of the kinds of economic benefits that happen when you replace a vacant lot or an abandoned building and those sort of things. There are multiple capital funding application processes necessary now. You can't just do it with one funding stream. That can often delay a project. We really need to figure out how to coordinate those things. The fact is that these agencies, city agencies, have done a very good job of doing that. For instance, the HDR application this year had OMH service and operating dollars inside the application. You could apply for them with your capital. That was a great step forward and allowed them to fund 249 units in New York housing this year. We also got to look at the REDC process. Regional Economic Development Councils are now going to take a look at housing proposals that go to HDR. They will weigh in with 20% of the points in rating those things. The fact is we have had discussions with Irene Baker, who's leading it for the governor, and talked to people about this, and we're getting a lot of good response, and we can work together with them. But the fact is we've got to be careful that Medicaid redesign does not take a backseat to economic development. They're both important, and we want to make sure that the economic development world understands the importance of housing vulnerable populations in their regions. Other systemic concerns, which may or may not impact us, there is a growing demand for the state's volume cap in bonds. The state has a limited amount of tax-exempt bonds they can put towards housing. Those can be used for supportive housing, which is one of the big push forwards that we've had in the last few years with HDR, has really taken tax-exempt bonds that never were used for supportive housing and now build hundreds of units each year. Those bonds usually were used in the 80-20 program, which provided 20% affordable housing units in market rate development. For a while, there wasn't so much demand for market rate rental housing. That has really gone through the roof in the last couple of years, and there's a lot of demand for 80-20 projects now from private developers. They could really take over much of the volume cap. We've heard of projects that would take over $1 billion of volume cap for market rate housing with an affordable component, but not nearly as many units as we could build with that going straight affordable. Sunny May is concerned about exposure to OMH projects. They back up OMH projects when they're built by DASNY. If you don't use Sunny May to provide basically the insurance on OMH's continued servicing of the debt, then you have to go get a letter of credit from a bank. That will increase your cost in development. Investor confidence needs to be maintained. Tax credits have private investors. We have educated them on what supportive housing is, and I think people are very comfortable with that now, but we have to make sure that they know that the operating costs are going to be covered, the services will be there. And the fact is that a lot of this is driven by Community Reinvestment Act demand by the banks. The banks are investing in projects according to where they have branches. Central New York doesn't have a whole lot of CRA demand the way it does in downstate, and even Western New York is better than that. So we have to be aware of that. We also have just the logistics of building. We have a lot of delays in temporary certificate occupancy at the end of building broke out and ready, and then wait 3 months to get the fire department and the buildings department to approve. So we have, those are logistical concerns we can take a look at. Service and operating challenges once you've built it. The fact is supportive housing has really been looking at flat service funding for many years. New York 3 service contracts were robust in 2006. They stayed flat for the last 5 years. New York 1 and 2 got a little bump up years back, but they're pretty low. OMH supportive housing funding is probably the place where we have the most concern, because when it started out, the idea was that half of the money went to rent and half of the money paid for services. Now about 85%, right? And Tony, you might be able to tell me, but most of it goes to rent.
It depends on where in the state you are, but certainly New York City, the vast majority of the money goes to rent.
So we're providing services to people living in scattered site apartments, but not nearly as much services as we used to. There's inadequate administrative overhead. There's multiple agency oversight, which probably could be simplified. Tenants that we're seeing have more challenging service needs. We've been able to handle that, but it is more challenging. It does take our time. There's reduced developer fees. There's reduced philanthropic support. So the safety net for nonprofits that are out on the limb when they're trying to build is getting thinner. And then there's uncertainties associated with Medicaid redesign. We're going to need to take those head on. If we were to facilitate an expansion of supportive housing, I hope the group will do. I mean, there's a few things that we can do, and I'm really just touching on the bare bones. I think there's probably more ideas around this table than just this, but you know, certainly we could require all publicly funded affordable housing development to include supportive units. Now, you need to make sure that there's services there, and you need to have that service coverage no matter where you are at the state and other things. So that's complex, but it's not a goal that we could be working towards. Sean Fitzgerald and Mike Scrivitenis talked about the supportive housing set aside at HDR, which is a great step forward put together by them a few years back. It's now going inside to the Regional Economic Development Council. If I was sitting on an REDC seat, I'd probably see that $2.2 million of tax credits as a ceiling, not a floor. Up till now, it's been a floor, not a ceiling. So we may need to increase funding for that to make sure that we're getting the same number of units. And we might want to do it even more so we can get more units for these purposes of the populations we're serving. Release OMH capital funds. We could take a look at vacancies that come up in the housing stock that HDR and HPD have already built and target these to high-cost Medicaid users. We could provide a revolving pool of pre-development and acquisition funds, because that's a great way to save time and money. I mean, the fact is if you do those soil borings all over the lot, before you build, you will know what you're getting into, and you won't have delays. That's one of the biggest contributors to delays. But a lot of times, nonprofits aren't allowed to do all that pre-development stuff as well as they ought to. Coordinating agency capital application processes and linking them to service and operating funding awards, that's already starting to happen, but we can do much more. Ensure the service levels are adequate to tenant needs, and create tenant tools and incentives that encourage stable tenants to move on to more independent housing. Moving on, there's been a couple of initiatives that have shown some promise that need to be tweaked, and we might be able to move people who are stable in supportive housing into more independent apartments where we're only paying for their rent, and we have just a safety net of assistance but not constant supportive services. And that will really, I think, free up units for people that have higher service needs. You could also look at some of the proposals that Housing Works has proposed for the HIV population. The fact is that people on in rental subsidies for people living with HIV/AIDS for non-supportive units, they often pay as much as 60% of their income towards rent. If you cap that at 30%, it would take away the biggest disincentive for people with HIV/AIDS living in supportive housing to move to more independent housing. So that would be a good way to free up more units for the more needy. There's a couple other proposals they've given that have that are interesting as well. Lastly, I'm just going to finish with a map of what other available housing resources there are in the state. We have 210,000 units of public housing stock. 180,000 of those are in New York City. We don't have much experience providing supportive services to those. There are a lot of people living in the public housing that could benefit from the services, and there are a lot of people that could move in if we could provide services attached to those units. Section 8 housing choice vouchers, I was surprised to see that there's actually 224,000 statewide. That's a lot. Those turn over. Some of those, those get held on to for a long time, too, so it's not nearly as many as that, but it is a start. HDR and HBD, between them, have financed 99,000 units that are out there. They're affordable. If we could take a look at prioritizing this population for vacancies in that housing stock and making sure that they have the appropriate levels of services, I think that would be a great place to look. Section 202 and 811 housing for seniors and people with disabilities, funded by federal funds. There's 13,000 units out there. McKinney-Vento permanent supportive housing, there's 23,000 units, which Linda Glassman talked about. They're occupied now, but we need to look at how we're using those and whether we can prioritize certain populations for them. The Housing Development Corporation in New York City does not do supportive housing in the way that HDR uses its tax-exempt bonds. There's other project-based Section 8 buildings that may be a source for new units. The 80-20 program has 20% affordable units. We've done a small pilot of moving people that are graduated from supportive housing into those affordable units, and it's working quite well. We could do more. I don't know the first thing about foreclosed properties, but there sure are a lot of them out there. We should try to figure out how to use them, because the fact is that you'll see that supportive housing brings to the table something. It brings together operating subsidies, and right now people are having a hard time paying for rent. So landlords and developers are very interested in anybody that has a Section 8 or some kind of rent subsidy that will get them in the door, and they really are welcoming us with open arms. They also like the fact that there are services attached. It not only stabilizes those individuals, it stabilizes the whole building. So there's a real openness among private developers now to supportive units in their building. Then also there's the nursing home transitional diversion waiver, money falls to person, and all sorts of things that could be under an 1115 waiver that we should explore, but Mark knows way more about those things than I, so I'll stop right there. Thank you.
Okay. I hope you found that helpful and a foundation for our further discussions. Again, we're time challenged, even in the delayed phase, but if there are any observations that people would like to make,
the one observation I would make, which is really a comment to one of the observations you made, Ted, about the availability or lack of availability of sites or parcels. And, from Health and Hospitals' perspective, we have campuses or parcels because we look to consolidate, in which, there's opportunity for partnership in that regard. And the other observation I would make is the review, in fact, of vacant scattered-site apartments or other types of units, because I'm not quite sure, frankly, how organized or structured that is, but I know that it's incredibly important as we're looking at emerging populations, particularly those that, where my particular interest is people who, again, are utilizing a significant amount of Medicaid resources and for want of supportive housing in which there can be linkages. And the third area, which I think was referenced, is as it relates to public housing, I understand from at least our colleagues in New York City that there are a significant number of elderly tenants who no longer need the sized apartments that they're in, for which there could also be that an opportunity for some partnership as to helping those individuals with getting the kind of housing they need and would want, and making available then housing for those supportive families or individuals who may want to live with friends and colleagues in a larger apartment.
If you have sites, watch out. There's a bunch of developers going to come up to you right now.
They already have.
I was glad to see the priced out data cited in presentation, because it's really powerful numbers, and the paper is really good at laying out the housing crisis and the disability. there's the 2010 version, so I think it was great.
Oh, great.
To the work group. There are people with disabilities and seniors living in institutions that, and support housing that don't need the services, but it's the only option for housing that they have. We hear from housing counselors all the time that the individual is coming in saying, I'm homeless and I'm depressed, and their best option is helping them get a diagnosis of depression so that they can get into the supportive housing system. Because there's no other option out there. Mm-hmm. Most of the Section 8, waiting lists are closed or, have to wait here. We know there are 22,000 people living in nursing homes in New York that have indicated they want out from CMS, and that's not including IPS and the IMDs. So we definitely, we need to make sure that we're looking at all options for independent, accessible, affordable, and creative housing in this work group so that we can open the beds in those facilities and in supportive housing for the people that need those services. And one of the options that wasn't mentioned that alternate rooms wanted to raise was the 10B rental assistance, which is used, funded under home through HBR, and it can be used to not only do rent vouchers for individuals, but also help pay their security deposits to get them out of the institution. And you can actually make a priority to target people who want to get out of the institution. We have more information on that, and we can circulate it, but it hasn't been used much in New York State, and there's definitely ways to use the HUD money and the money we get from feds to more effectively to take advantage of that. And just one more thing I wanted to address, also speaking to some of the points that Susie made about the lack of funding coming from the feds, HUD's definition of homelessness doesn't include people in institutions at risk for institutional engagement. Disability advocates have been making, advocating at the federal level for them to change this definition for years. It would have two major impacts. One is that then those individuals would be able to access services and programs through that network, but also that if HUD was looking at the larger picture of the number of people that need housing in the state, then actually could get more money potentially. So advocacy from the state to the federal government can go a long way.
Two other items that I think might be interesting to capture are VA resources, to the extent to which they overlay or intersect with some of the populations. And also looking at points of friction in the operations of any of these programs, not from the capital funding standpoint, but length of time it takes to process people's applications to the capital, delays and turnover. Rework situations that delay people in institutions. I think there's a process of proof expenses that in the background could be important as far as attacking the turnover, the efficiency of utilization.
Few things that I just wanted to highlight, and building on what you said with the definition issue, in New York City, since providers are working with three levels of government, programs, you have different definitions of homelessness criteria from the federal government, state programs, city programs, and multiple funding streams. So sometimes that's a barrier as far as getting everything in place, and that's something that we should look at. And then I also wanted to point out, Bob mentioned the full team study, and that showed basically that supportive housing for homeless mental adults with mental health basically paid for itself and provided big savings in other areas. Medical and behavioral health services, criminal justice, homeless services. So that goes in line with a lot of the issues that the MRC is looking at as far as saving Medicaid dollars and increasing the outcomes of services. And maybe there's also opportunities to reinvest some savings into supportive housing. And the last thing that I noticed was the 1115 waiver that OPWDD is developing. We could probably look at other opportunities to expand it into mental health.
Thank you. I guess I have a question in terms of where the specific might fit in this body as well as in the continuum. I think that the task of outreach design was assigned to this work group, and there really hasn't been a lot of discussion of the frail elderly. The truth is, two-thirds of our industry are people. Well, you can argue, rather than apartment, not having this congregate housing. Two-thirds of our industry are students who choose to spend their own resources to live in assisted living, either for social reasons or because they need the assistance. We hear the significant existing, fairly new housing stock that Medicaid would, you know, that we could leverage, I think, and, you know, provide more affordable assisted living for seniors who need the assistance. So I guess my question is, is this the right forum to talk about
lobbying? Sure, it is the right forum. Okay, we're running out of time here, so let me just go forward. I would like to task you, because we don't have many meetings. We're on a very tight schedule. Ask all of you with some additional work as well. I think the goal of our second meeting is going to try and develop a working definition of our problem. We need to size the issue. First of all, let me just say, is it Jason? Yeah. I don't think for this purpose of this group we need to worry about the developing of argument that there is a problem. We formed one of 10 working groups because we recognize supportive housing. The development of additional supportive housing is critical to bending the cost curve in Medicaid over the long term and preserving the Medicaid program. So we're acknowledging that we have to do a better job in evolving supportive housing and making it available for complex needs population. And we would like to go forward with a very strong argument for reinvesting resources from the Medicaid program to supportive housing. Some of you may have heard that there's consideration underway for the development of a new Medicaid waiver program that will provide the outline structure for the operation of Medicaid program going forward in New York. Certainly one of the things that we'd like to look at as part of that initiative would be an opportunity for reinvestment. Medicaid program at $53 billion is an obvious choice when we're looking for a source of developing capital and for supporting housing going forward. So we don't have to get into that with any level of detail. There is a problem we're trying to solve it here. So I think the next meeting we really should be working on a better definition of what the problem is, both in terms of the scope and the character of that problem. We've gotten a lot of good information here today that's going to help us do that. I know all of you are very much involved in the, as they say these days, in the weeds of things. You know a lot of detail, and we want that detail to come forward. But to the extent that you can categorize it into sort of broad strategic categories, that would be helpful. Ray talked about two problems that I think fit under the definition of better utilizing
right.
the resources available. So there's going to be a lot of specifics that we can probably fit into better utilization. Correcting regulatory barriers. I think we talked about assisted living and redesigning that program. I think that's very much about correcting regulatory barriers. So if all of you could think about helping us with a better problem definition, both with respect to scope and character for the next meeting. I'd like to come out of the next meeting with a consensus about how we're going to speak about the supportive housing problem, and then that would set us up for the third meeting, which hopefully will be about maybe concrete recommendations about where the state can go, given its reasonable resource limitations, both in terms of the finances available, financial means available to us, but also given the organizational wherewithal that's practically available to us. So if you would help us with that, the November 10th, I think, is the next meeting. If you could get your suggestions to Mark and Andy, I think that would be very, in the relatively near future, that would be very helpful. Fair enough?
I just wonder if you could help us with some parameters of the goal, given the short amount of time that we have to work with. I know, for instance, on health disparities, it wasn't until we were like, you know, three quarters of the way through that we realized that we could only submit 10 proposals. So sort of what are the limitations of what we can put forward on this list?
You know, I don't know. There are going to be, obviously, recommendations we're going to make in the area of resources and recommendations we're going to make in terms of statute and regulation that can be carried forward without resource consideration. Obviously, the resource issues are going to be, resource proposals are going to be more difficult for us. We all know we're operating within a very difficult financial environment in New York. I think we're prepared to argue on behalf of reinvestment, but that is obviously limiting. Reinvestment suggests that we're going to have savings up front in order to reinvestment, not just about the long term, but it's about generating savings up front in order to support reinvestment. On the regulatory statutory side, I don't think we're really limited. Except by this complex political world that's out there that really restricts, I guess, the appetite for change in any particular given year. So I think we'll have to prioritize and try and find out and identify those issues that we think are most critical, most important to proceed with this year.
I think that I agree with you. I think from the regulatory point of view, if you were to take a look at the funding streams, federal, state, and city, and then take a look at their requirements and even their eligibility criteria, I think there are recommendations that could be made that could maybe streamline some of the, or at least recommend that you eliminate some of the impediments that you have to accessing housing that I think would work. Brought up here, and I would agree also with Marvin also that we have to take a look at the federal government, take a look at all of the housing programs that they have as well, because you could conceivably develop a federal agenda and conceivably develop a city agenda on how to make some improvements to access to housing and to the development of housing.
Certainly, and there's large federal role in development. Advocacy set of recommendations that would be helpful in coordinating our position with respect to our advocacy position with respect to federal
reserve. And then, if I may, I just want to make one friendly comment that the former chairman of the housing authority. Well, one third of that is the household in public housing are seniors, and many of them could be in larger apartments because their children have moved out. You probably have maybe three families that are overcrowded that are waiting to move into those apartments once you decide what to do with the seniors. One of the things that I had looked at was really assisted living as a model that could be used to be able to move seniors into assisted living and then be able to move people that were overcrowded into larger apartments. So that could be something that could be looked at as well. And the last thing that I would say is that having been kind of an insider, there are some things that the federal government could do that may require legislative approval, but the HUD commissioner, and I know the government knows this, have the authority to make some administrative or changes by executive order that could also be helpful in providing access to housing. An example of that would be some of the programs that will not take someone out of an institution into housing, which is a problem in drug treatment. You could be someone in recovery finishing treatment, but the housing authority and other programs will require you to be in recovery for 2 years before you're eligible for housing, which is, I understand from both sides, is somewhat of an impediment. I understand the housing arguments on it, but it's also through a many population that and access programs. And those are the things that I think will in the regulatory.
Sure. Well, again, you can organize your thoughts and provide a room to the try and put them in some form that we can bring them back to the group and
You know, as we look at, you know, our ultimate end goals of this particular conversation, I'm just curious, how important will it be to sort of marshal our regulatory sort of ideas, then giving, will this actually end up having some component of impact on a budget goal to the fiscal year 12?
Thank you.
Thank you.